From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Luis Ojos' 2009 film called The Cove, about dolphin slaughter in Japan, won an Oscar and captured the world's attention. And his latest film, called Racing Extinction, uses similar techniques, like hidden cameras and microphones, to expose the illegal trade of endangered species. He travels to exotic places where people traffic in shark fins and manta ray gills and all manner of creatures in cages. But the film is about more than just those distant atrocities, because Sohoyo says none of that really compares to the damage we're all doing in our day-to-day lives, driving and consuming and eating. Still, he knows images are powerful ways of getting people to change. We're continuing our series on documentary film today. Luis Sohoyos will join us after the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The filmmaker and photographer Luis Ojos knows images are powerful things. They can ignite movements and inspire change. Take his 2009 film, The Cove, about dolphin slaughter in Japan. The outrage from that film went viral. It won an Academy Award and began this conversation about fishing practices throughout the world. His latest film will promote that same kind of reaction. In it, hidden cameras expose the trafficking of endangered species like sharks and manta rays and other creatures. But the film also takes an interesting turn back on itself, because it's also about the damage being done by all of us in the fossil fuels we burn, in the foods we consume. And so Hoyos doesn't leave himself out of this. In fact, he did a carbon assessment of the process of making this documentary, and he says the worst thing you can do to the environment is make a film about it. Still, he knows the images are powerful ways of getting people to change. We're continuing our series in documentary film today by talking about Luis Ojos' film. It's called Racing Extinction. It premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. We're screening it next Thursday evening. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll give you details about that a little bit later in the program. Luis Ojos is joining us today from the studios of member station KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. That's where he's based. And Luis Ojos, welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me.
It seems like this film, I'm trying to compare it to the Cove, and it seems like in some ways this is more personal. It seems more a first-person piece in some ways than The Cove. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're both in the genre of, I guess you call it an eco-thriller. But this one, yeah, was a lot more personal. You know, I used to be a photographer for National Geographic magazine. I worked over the course of about two decades, and I did four stories on the Mesozoic. That's the midlife of the planet, basically the age of dinosaurs. I wrote a book about paleontology called Hunting Dinosaurs. And when you're going to these landscapes, I've been all over the world with some of the, you know, the greatest paleontologists of our day. And when you're going to these landscapes, you're always thinking, what happened? What could cause these animals to die out? I mean, people think of dinosaurs as not being successful, but they were around for 165 million years. Our own species, Homo sapiens, has been around for, you know, maybe 200,000. So, I mean, we like to think of ourselves as being on top of the food chain, but, you know, we're not the most successful animal in existence. You know, dinosaurs are really still on top because some of them evolved and became birds. There's 9,500 species of birds, and there's about 4,500 species of mammals. So, you know, dinosaurs are still doing well. But what you think about when you see these, you know, animals come and go all the time. A species should last anywhere between 1 and 4 million years on the planet before it dies off. But what's going on right now is we're losing species 1,000 times faster than we should be. There's a mass extinction event going on right now. And that was a shocker to me. So, yeah, I mean, the last 6 years I've been spending to try to not just inform, you know, on a mass scale that this is what's going on, but what can we do to prevent it?
I want to play a moment in the film that really, I think, captures your personal connection to this story and really the sense of urgency that you're conveying in the film. It's this moment where you're talking about a dolphin, a species called the Baiji dolphin. And you can sense how connected you are. And this seems to really get at a big theme in the film. Let me play this moment, Luis Ojeos from Racing Extinction.
About 2 decades ago, the Baiji dolphin was extremely vulnerable. There was hundreds of them left. I mean, I thought, well, there's enough out there. Somebody's going to do something to save this animal. This animal, it wasn't just the last of its species. It was the last of an entire family of cetaceans. So I thought, humans, somebody somewhere has got to go out and save these animals. They have to because they're dying off. They're all gone now. They went extinct. In my lifetime, they went extinct. So we always think that there's going to be somebody else around to save these animals.
Is that part of the thing that motivates you? This idea that you sort of figured somebody was going to take care of this, and now you think, you know, I've got to be part of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's going on all over the world. I mean, it's just the Baiji's gone, but every river dolphin in the world's, you know, about to go extinct. You know, there's some scientists say there's 30,000 species that are dying out. You know, and the idea that this is going on all around us and that we're oblivious to it, or even worse, don't care, is unfathomable to me. And so what I'm trying to do with the film is, you know, is not just, like I said before, to create the awareness, but to motivate, like we did with The Cove, but on a mass scale. I mean, you know, to give people a little bit of a background, you know, The Cove was about, you know, dolphin hunting in Japan. Most of the swim with dolphin programs in the world are stocked out of this little cove, and it's in Taiji, Japan. It's actually the slaughter just started up on the first of this month. But we've helped reduce the slaughter, you know, because of this film and all the other organizations that got involved since we did it. We've reduced the slaughter from somewhere about 23,000 down to about 6,000. So, you know, I can see the power of a film to galvanize people to, you know, to take action. And we're trying to do that with this film too, but on a mass scale. But, you know, I want to say that I don't want to bring people down. The film, to me, at the end, I hope is very hopeful. It gives people a sense that, you know, not of what's the word that, you know, that they feel that they can't do anything, but it should be empowerment.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, it's empowered. You know, we can't rely on the next generation of kids to do anything about it. But, you know, the unborn. We're the people that are alive right now are the only people in existence that can take the situation and actually reverse it. And what we do now is going to shape the planet millions of years from now. And I want people to get a sense of the responsibility, you know, the debt that we have to all future generations to take care of this issue right now.
Yeah.
My friends in paleontology say that when you look back, when we look back, you know, humanity looks back at, say, our life on the planet since the Industrial Revolution from the year 2100, they will look back and World War II will be a footnote in history compared to what we're doing right now, which is allowing this biodiversity to basically expire on our watch. And I think it's of that scale. I mean, people are going to look back and say, like Jane Goodall says in our film, you know, how did those people at that time just allow all these amazing creatures to vanish? And I want to give people a sense that, you know, we're it.
Yeah.
There's nobody else that we can look up to. It's us.
We're going to come back around to hope because I think it's an important part of the film too. So I also don't want to give people the sense that this is just a downer. But, you know, I think you have to work through the really troubling parts of this story if you're going to get people's attention. So we're going to talk about some of that. And one of the things that you convey is sort of the state of things where we are now. This idea that, and this really struck me, Luis Ojeos, that we are in the next few decades going to be driving species to extinction. Is this right? 1,000 times higher than normal?
Yeah, Stuart Pym from Duke University did extensive surveys of, you know, biodiverse hot spots around the planet and found out that we are in some places we're driving to right now to extinction at 10,000 times faster than they should be. But when you look at all the species on the planet, we don't even know how many species that there are on the planet, but we're probably losing them faster than scientists' ability to record that they're even here on the planet with us. There's about 1.5, 1.6 million species that have been identified. We think that, you know, there might be somewhere between 15 and 30 million, you know, animals on the planet. We don't even know by an order of magnitude, but we do know that we're causing these species to vanish before we can even record that they're here.
You say that we look at the world through these eyes and ears, and we figure and this is so interesting because it's like this human perspective. We see things, the things that we're able to register with our ears and the things that we're able to see. This is a point made in the film, is really a fraction of what's really out there, because part of this is about this hidden world. And I want to talk a little bit about that. But first, you need to introduce Christopher Clark. Because he plays an interesting role in this film.
Oh yeah, well Christopher Clark was the director of the Cornell Bioacoustical Laboratory. It's the biggest repository of animal songs on the planet. You know, they've been collecting them since the 1930s, and it was really interesting. That's kind of how this whole movie, this whole project got started. I was down in the Caribbean, and I basically found a fisherman. He found this buoy on the beach and returned it to our boat. And basically, through our interpreter, says, "Can you give us a $500 reward that's offered on this buoy?" And I said, "Just a minute, let me take a look at this buoy." And it said, "You know, return to Chris Clark Cornell Bioacoustic Laboratory." I thought, you know, I know this guy;
right.
He's a friend of mine. And so we go to the. It's an amazing place up on a pond up in Cornell. Beautiful location, and they have, you know, the biggest repository of animal songs on the planet. And here's the cool thing: the original title for this film, which is called Racing Extinction, the original title was called The Singing Planet, and that's because Chris told me that everything on the planet with a heartbeat has been singing. We just haven't been listening. You know, everything from an insect up to a blue whale has a song in it.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about the blue whale is most of its if the register of its song is below our threshold for hearing. And that's you're absolutely right. That's a very big premise of the movie, is because the human body is a really blunt instrument to perceive reality. Because, you know, you look at the world through these ears and you think that's all there is to hear. But a blue whale has the loudest song in the animal kingdom. It can basically Chris proved that these animals could hear each other communicating over ocean basins thousands and thousands of miles apart. In fact, in the Southern Ocean, they can probably hear in a quiet ocean, they can hear themselves clear around the planet where there's no landmass in the way in the Southern Ocean. And, you know, even our eyes, you know, the electromagnetic spectrum, you know, from ultraviolet light to infrared light is a very wide band of light. And like one of the researchers in our film says, you know, it's like having your eyes to perceive the world is like having a grand piano in your house but only be able to hear one note on it.
Right, right. Yeah, let me play this moment. This is Chris Clark. What's great about it is, you know, you talk about in the film this long, deep, slow arc of how a blue whale communicates, and you can't really hear it until you speed it up. Here's a clip from the film, Racing Extinction.
So the first time I knew there was a blue whale singing nearby, I could see it on the display, but I couldn't hear it. So what do you have to do? You have to speed it up. And still, the hair goes up on the back of my neck, and it's like, damn, that's fabulous. As we listen more and more around different parts of the planet, whether it's frozen Arctic Ocean or the deepest jungles of Central Africa, the whole world is singing. Clicking and grinding and whistling and thumping. But we've stopped listening.
Luis Hoyos is with us. He directed and appears in the new documentary film Racing Extinction. We're screening it next Thursday night. That's September 10th at 7 p.m. at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Luis Hoyos is going to join us. He'll be there for the Q&A after the film. Admission is free, but remember, the seating is limited, so you're going to need to get there early to get your seat. We have all of the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the filmmaker and photographer and activist Luis Hoyos, who captured the world's attention a few years ago, won an Oscar with the film The Cove, about the yearly dolphin hunt in Japan. His latest film premiered at Sundance this year, just as outrageous in many ways. It's another undercover expose in many ways, this one about the international wildlife trade of endangered species. The film is called Racing Extinction. We're screening it next Thursday night. Luis Hoyos is joining us today to talk about it. We'll give you details about the screening a little bit later on the program. Luis Hoyos, this struck me, the fact that you mentioned in the film 800 environmental activists have been killed in the last decade. Would you say something about that, the role of activists as a part of this film?
Yeah, I mean... You know, there's a lot of money to be lost by people. You know, when people protect environment, let's say in Brazil where they're knocking down the forests basically to raise cattle illegally for meat production. There's people out there trying to defend this property, trying to defend the rights of citizens to have these forests, and a lot of them are dying. They're getting killed by people that want to continue to exploit the natural resources. It's happening all over the world, but you never hear about these people. These are people that are losing their lives because they understand the issue. They understand what's at stake. Once you lose a habitat, you usually don't get it back. It's gone forever. And with it, most of the creatures that lived in it. And so, you look at some lumber companies or these illegal cattle industries that are going on in South America, they're just looking at it, okay, we can knock this down and we can put some cattle on it and we can make a quick buck. But that, those forests that are turned over into the pastures, they only last maybe a decade. And then they go fallow and then the trees don't go back. It takes, some of these environments, it takes hundreds of thousands of years for them to come back. They don't come back instantly. And if you look at, it might be jumping ahead of where you want to go, but you look at what we're doing to the oceans right now, we're acidifying it. Mm-hmm. We're acidifying the oceans right now so that there's, at the current rate, by 2100, the coral reefs will be gone. They'll be dissolved because of the carbonic acid that's being absorbed by the oceans. And when you lose the coral reefs, you lose 25% of the species in the oceans. Mm-hmm. If you've ever put on a mask and you've gone to the Caribbean or the Pacific or anywhere and see those beautiful life forms, these alien creatures, exquisitely beautiful, they're called the rainforests of the oceans. Mm-hmm. That's going to be gone.
Yeah.
And when you start to look at what's at stake and people say, well, we need our cheap energy. How cheap is that? How cheap is it when you're losing habitats that are going to be gone for millions of years? The reefs, once you dissolve the reefs, it takes anywhere between 1 and 7 million years for them to come back. And we've always lost the coral reefs previous to every mass extinction event, and that's what's going on right now.
Well, that's what you say. One of the common factors here on all of the extinctions so far has been this massive increase in carbon dioxide. And I have to say, one of the most beautiful collections of images in the film, and there are a lot, by the way, so this is saying something, but are these images of these vulnerable microscopic creatures that fill the oceans, the phytoplankton? There's a terrific marine ecologist who is featured in the film, a man by the name of Boris Worm. It's a great name. And he talks about the miniature architecture that fills the oceans. Would you talk a little bit about that and the role? Because I think a lot of people feel disconnected from the ocean, but every breath we take, you say, makes this connection.
Yeah, but Boris Worm is a fairly controversial character in science, and everything he's he said is coming to play out, unfortunately. He was part of a group of scientists that predicted we're going to lose all of the major fish stocks by 2048. And it turns out that'll, you know, mostly be right, but it'll probably come earlier than that. He's come out with a paper recently that said we might have lost, I think it was 40% of plankton production in just the last 50 years. And like you say, you know, at least every other breath that we take, we owe to plankton. Plankton is not just the base of the food chain. It's responsible for most of the oxygen that we breathe. And we may be losing as much as 1% of it a year right now. And even if it's a percentage of that, the idea that we would then knowingly basically kill off our life support system for cheap energy is unfathomable. Why would we do that? If we're, you know, the great irony is that our own species name, Homo sapiens, means the wise ones. And, you know, this new epoch that we're embarking on, you know, this new extinction event, the scientists have a name for it. It's called the Anthropocene, yeah. The age of man, because this new extinction event is totally caused by mankind. You know, ironically, the creature that calls himself the wise one.
I wanted to talk about a group of activists that are, I think, the main characters in the film. Sean Heinrichs is one, quits his job as the CEO of this tech company, and at some point hooks up with a man by the name of Paul Hilton, a photojournalist, Australian man. And they're this team. They're this great team. They're this sort of yin and yang in some ways. Sean's pretty intense. Paul's a little bit more laid back, but they're this team, and they have this technique where they go out and they get these images. Talk about Paul Hilton and Sean Heinrichs, if you would.
Yeah, we wanted to see the illegal wildlife markets in China, so I hired them to basically be our tour guides through these illegal markets. You know, they've been there before, I hadn't, and as we're going there, I meet these two characters, and they're out of central casting, yeah. And they quickly became a major part of the film because just the relationship is so remarkable. And then, unbeknownst to us, they had, you know, they said, okay, you want to go and, you know, observe the illegal wildlife markets because of what we've done with the Cove, where we used a lot of, you know, hidden cameras and basically spy techniques to infiltrate the Cove. They thought, okay, well, he'll want to be part of these actions that they've been planning. So we go there and we're posing. They had us like posing as, you know, basically buyers of endangered wildlife. Yeah. So now we're in the middle of these covert operations and, you know, pretty much just thrown right into it. And it was scary. It was way scarier than doing the Cove because now you're facing the perpetrators head on and you're pretending to be somebody other than, you know, who we really are. So because I was the oldest of the group, I was always the main buyer.
Right.
And of course, I knew nothing about the products that they were, you know, that they were there. We were there purported to buy. So, you know, I had to get up to speed real quickly. And, basically everybody in the team had a role, like, you know, a science advisor, somebody was an economist, you know, trying to advise us on the price of things. So we got up to speed. And because we had these hidden cameras and cameras rolling all the time, a lot of times we'd have like five cameras on a scene so that when we caught them, we did a pretty good job. One thing we didn't talk about in the film, but we had infiltrated this. He was the biggest seller of endangered whales, sharks on the planet. This guy had at the time there's only three protected species of sharks by CITES. That's the Convention for International Trade of Endangered Species. And this guy was selling barrels of oil from all three. These were whale sharks, great whites, and basking sharks.
Yeah.
And this guy is selling tons and tons of it around the planet every year. But one thing we didn't talk about, and it's probably too late to put in the film, but there was seven operations going on in this town illegally. We closed down six of them. So the film really, what we did over there had a big impact on the species because, you know, a lot of these animals, it's not like they're spawning, you know, 500,000, you know, fish eggs. They have a couple pups every generation. And when you're wiping out, you know, let's say 600 whale sharks in an area every year, you can quickly, you know, make a species go extinct.
these, I have to say that moment where you go and infiltrate this man who has, you know, this the oil operation. There's this really scary moment where your mic, you're basically wired, and your mic cord is kind of showing. And so one of the guys who's with you says, Louis, come with me for just a minute. You have to step outside and you have to cover it up. And there's this moment where you wonder, did he see it? I mean, you know, was your cover blown? It's kind of scary.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, like I can only relate it to the Cove where we're basically planting hidden cameras and then we have to go back to retrieve them. That was scary because if they found the cameras that day, if we came back to retrieve them that evening, we'd be found out.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, we're spending sometimes a couple days with these people and you're always worried that you're going to blow your cover. Yeah, so at that point, you know, we became very, very paranoid at that point.
Right.
When this, you know, that you thought, okay, are we being set up? If there's a gap in the conversation, is it the time where he's calling his friends to have us beat up?
Yeah.
You know, so I was just so happy to get out of there and then finally expose him.
There's another moment where you get into this processing plant, this warehouse for shark fins. We can't show it, obviously, because we're on the radio, but will you give us a sense of the scale of what you saw? Because it's wall-to-wall, thousands of square feet of shark fins, and it's kind of hard to even describe.
Yeah, I mean, a shark has, you know, they'll get about 6 to 7 fins off of it, and there was probably the fins from about 12,000 animals on top of this roof, drying out in the sun. You know, this just pallets stacked high, and this is right in Hong Kong Harbor. The scale was just, you know, it's one thing when people say that, you know, there's 250,000 sharks killed every day for the fin trade, but when you start to see them, it makes a very visceral reaction. You know, the thing is, you need everything in the ocean, you know, for the oceans to survive the way they are. There's all these checks and balances. And so when you take out animals like a shark, everything else can start to fail.
Yeah.
And we're doing that. In this one generation that I've been alive, we've cut down the ranks of sharks, which have been around, you know, for 400 million years. They survived 4 mass extinction events. We've cut, in just the generation, in the last 50 years, we cut down the ranks about 90%. So it doesn't take that much to cause a mass extinction. We're very, very good at doing it. You know, the human species, we've become brilliant at vacuuming up the seas, you know, clearing the skies of songbirds, clearing out, you know, vast, you know, spaces that were thought to be impossible to do, and basically mowing down all the creatures that have come through the same gauntlet of history to be here that we have. And we're wiping out in just a few generations on sea and on land and in the air. It's, you know, passenger pigeons used to be, you know, the biggest migration in history, you know, used to basically darken the skies for, you know, tens of hours at a time. And, you know, they went extinct in like 1914, something like that. Where once there was billions of animals, now there are none.
Yeah. I want to play another clip because I think this gives you a sense of Sean Heinrichs and the kinds of things that he is seeing in the world and driving his activism, because this is related to shark fins, of course. He tells the story of traveling with these shark thinners in Indonesia. And shark thinners, they basically cut the fins off the sharks and in some cases just leave the animal there in the ocean without these fins. And this is a particular story from the film Racing Extinction.
And then one morning, I saw something reflecting off on the coral reef in the shallow water. And what I discovered was just horrific. It's this beautiful tawny nurse shark, but it had all its fins cut off. And it was trying to swim, but it couldn't swim. And it was heartbreaking because it's like, this is what the reality is. This is the thing that nobody gets.
What does he mean, the thing that nobody gets? What's the thing that nobody gets?
Well, I mean, there's some 70 million sharks being killed every year for the fin trade, you know, for something called shark fin soup. It's basically a tasteless, nutritionless soup for, served at Chinese banquets. And nobody sees the pain and suffering that goes on behind the scenes. That, to get that shark fin soup to their table, there's immense amounts of suffering. And when you see that animal, here's the good side of, everything that happens in the film that's bad that we've been talking about, it's always, if you look at the way the film's structured, it's always counterpointed with something really positive.
Yeah, because this image goes viral.
Exactly. Yao Ming, who, was the former NBA basketball player, did a PSA with Wild Aid, and over 1 billion people saw it throughout Asia. And that one PSA, this public service announcement, is probably responsible for dropping the trade in fins about 70%. So, and that's basically through this one image and the campaign that Wild Aid did with that Sean had done. So images are extremely powerful to change people's hearts and minds. And I want to clarify this. You don't change people's behavior by changing their mind. You do it by changing their heart. And when people all across Asia saw this, and they said, basically, if you knew how shark fin soup was made, could you still eat it? And then they show this image. It's basically a group of people eating at an aquarium. And in this aquarium, they superimposed Sean's Heidrinks's image of the shark without the fins. Yeah. And that one PSA is responsible for saving millions of sharks every year. So that's the hope in the film, is that one person like Sean Heidrinks actually can help change the world.
You said in the film that you didn't think the illegal wildlife trade would be so overt. But you go to certain places, Hong Kong in particular, China as well, to get to sort of the shark fin operation. But you also see all kinds of things, kind of, I have to say, unspeakable things on the streets. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because you say the more endangered it is, the more you have to go to the back rooms. But some of this is out in the open. I mean, can you talk about some of the things that you saw and document?
Yeah, the Guangzhou is probably where the SARS outbreak started, and it probably happened from this illegal wildlife market that's still active today. The government, the year that we were there, I think it was 2012, 2013, the government had shut it down twice. But it's such a lucrative business that this operation, which is huge. I mean, you're talking about over many, many acres. This operation starts very early in the morning, about 2, 3 in the morning. And they're selling – it's like a farmer's market in America, but in the back rooms they're selling illegal stuff. So you go there in the morning and you see these guys, basically trading in everything you could possibly imagine. And then when we were going by, they know that we're – We don't look Chinese. And so when we're walking down the streets, you see these big garage doors closing, the lights going off, and people basically just shutting down street in advance of us coming because they know what they're doing is illegal. And so we go to the back rooms, and you see where they're they're selling just about everything you can imagine, from rhino horn to elephant tusks to manta gills.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff, it's still legal there. A lot of the loopholes are still wide open, and they're being traded legally and illegally, throughout these shops, all mostly in Hong Kong.
But it raises this big question about the role that, and I want to work through this a little bit, the role that superstition and folk remedies work into this. You mentioned, so Sean Heidrinks is there and Peter Hilton are there in this back room, and they come across these plastic bags of manta gills, as you say. It's a really powerful moment from the film. And let me play this moment, and we can talk a little bit about it.
A few years ago, I started noticing species of manta and mobula ray lined up in the streets in areas that used to be predominantly shark ports. And it was really confusing to me because I understood that you can't use their wings for shark fin soup. And the meat from these rays is very pungent. It's not worth the time of bringing in these huge, heavy animals.
I couldn't believe when I walked in, it's just giant oceanic mantas all lined up in a row. And I just wanted to know what was going on. And then I started watching them cutting out the gills.
The gills are missing. Where did they put them? Where did they take the gills?
And it came down to this. There was an old cultural remedy in a very small coastal town in southern China, and that was over 50 years ago. And that had largely disappeared, but I think it was just following the SARS outbreak where somebody got it in their mind that, hey, we're running out of sharks. What other products can we move into the pipeline?
So all these gills end up in these Chinese medicine shops, and they all come from this idea that wasn't even considered true necessarily anymore. And these are the old folk remedies. How much of that idea, the superstition, do you think plays into this? Because it seems like that's an important part of all of that.
Yeah, well, there's the Chinese voice that's coming in there at the last moment, and of course you can't see it because of the subtitles, but he's saying that it's folklore.
Yeah.
It's based on, a rumor. And, so now you have a species like manta ray, which if you've ever dove with a manta ray, it is the most unbelievably beautiful animal in the ocean and probably rivals anything on land too. It's like a ballerina underwater, like a B-1 bomber that can dance. And they're so gorgeous, so beautiful. Now, all across Indonesia, which is where a lot of these manta rays are coming from, they're being exterminated for their gills, which are used to, cure sore joints and they think cancer. And I think the SARS outbreak had a big effect on China because people started to think, okay, these markets are really nasty, but if it's in a market, it's probably not good. But if it's coming from the wild, it's not perceived to be good. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so now this animal has been being exterminated over the just last couple decades because of this folk remedy. And of course, it has no medicinal properties whatsoever. And so the question becomes, well, how do you stop this? The villages in Indonesia, they make a lot of money from this.
Yeah.
And how do you stop that? How do you stop the demand?
I want to get to that because I think that's an important part of the film. What's the alternative you provide to these small – because there are two stories of two particular places where they've relied on this. And what's the alternative that you offer? I want to get to that when we get back from a break. Let me play as we head into this break Sean Heinrichs again, because he tells a beautiful story. You mentioned swimming with manta rays, and Sean has had that kind of experience. And he has this encounter, this beautiful encounter. Well, we don't need to say much more about it from the film Racing Extinction.
At the end of the last dive, everyone's out of the water. And I look down, and this one manta comes right underneath me and then just stops, and it hovers, and it's about 15 feet down, and it's not moving. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. And I look, and there's fishing line tailing off the top of its body. And the first thing I did is I swam down, and I snipped the line off the top of its head, right just above the hook. And swam up. She didn't swim away. She was just hovering right underneath me. So I swim back down to her one more time, and I put my hand gently right on the front of her head, and I put my hand on the hook, and I slowly work that hook right out of its top jaw. And I thought, that's it. She's going to swim off now. She's been saved. And I look down, and she's circling right under my feet. So I swim back down to her one more time, and I put my hand right next to where the injury was, as if sort of rubbing it, saying, hey, listen, you're going to be okay. And I put my head right next to her eye, and I just remember her eye moving back and forth between my mask, looking at both my eyes. And realized that she knew I was trying to help her.
Sean Heinrichs from the film Racing Extinction. We're showing the film next Thursday evening, September 10th at 7 p.m. at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Admission is free. Seating, though, is limited, so you'll need to get there early for a seat. The filmmaker, Luis Sohoyos, who's joining us today, will be with us to answer questions after the film. You can get details on our website, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us filmmaker Luis Sohoyos. We're talking about his film Racing Extinction, which premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. We're going to be screening it next Thursday evening as part of our Through the Lens series. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Luis Sohoyos will join us next Thursday, and we'll give you a little details about that a little bit later on the program. Luis joining us today from Boulder, Colorado, from NPR member station KGNU. That's where he's based. Well, I mentioned these two different places. One is Isla Mujer in the Caribbean. The other is Lomakera in Indonesia. And these are interesting stories because in both of these circumstances, you have a people who are relying on fishing, basically in the slaughter of these animals. And so you have to find an alternative if you're going to get them to turn away from it. Would you talk about these two contrasting stories because they're interesting?
Yeah, well, about less than 10 years ago, Sean Heinrichs went down to Isla Mujeres, where it was the biggest shark fishing island on the east coast of Mexico by far. You know, over 20 long lining boats that would go out every day, and that was their main business, is to hunt sharks. And you know, when Sean goes down there, he thought, well, you have this carnage going on. What can you do? And he basically helped set up a tourism operation so that people will now come from all around the world to go there to watch sharks. Now all these former shark fishermen are now tourists on these boats that have been upgraded. You know, they're making far more money than they ever did as shark fishermen. And they're hiring tourists to go and watch and, you know, like animals like whale sharks. I went down there with them about 2 years ago, and it was amazing. You know, one of these astounding, you know, bucket list things. Go, you know, basically just snorkel on top of the water with these whale sharks that are, you know, some cases 30, maybe 40 feet long, and there's hundreds of them. Mm. You know, all around in this area, they're feeding on eggs from fish that, you know, it's a very seasonal thing. But for about, you know, a month out of the season in July, you can dive with these whale sharks, and it's just, you know, it's like, you know, diving with dinosaurs. Yeah. These huge, huge animals that are, you know, feeding at the surface, and they're basically oblivious to the whale sharks are, you know, basically eating plankton. So they could gum you to death, but they can't, you know, I don't think anybody's ever been hurt by a whale shark. But there's manta rays in the water and hundreds of whale sharks. And now if you went out down there and you hunted a whale shark, you know, these fishermen would kill you because they're making a lot of money. And now Sean's doing the exact same thing. And, you know, in this little village in Indonesia called Lomakera, it's where they kill more manta rays than any other place on the planet for these gills that we talked about earlier. And, you know, but he's right at that nexus. You see him going into this village with Paul Hilton as his comrade, and they're basically trying to turn this manta fishing village into a tourist destination. Yeah. And since the film has come out, Sean has been there four times. He's actually there right now. And he's, you know, they don't have hotels. They don't have infrastructure. Yeah. But they have the boats, and, you know, nobody knows how to hunt mantas better than these manta fishermen. Something that was really interesting on this last trip, Sean told me he went there, and they had never seen a whale shark underwater. You know, they've been hunting them along with manta rays for quite a while, but they've never actually saw them underwater. So Sean got them, you know, this big group of fishermen, he got them all masked from this village, and they went underwater, and there was four boats out there, and there's one boat from another village, and they were watching this baby whale shark underwater, and you know, they were marveling, you know, the manta fishermen were all marveling at this baby whale shark underwater, and they hunt, you know, whale sharks as well. And this other villager, they harpooned this animal right in front of him.
Wow.
And it was shocking to Sean, but what happened was totally unplanned. The chief of the village got everybody together, you know, all the fishermen that were there, and they they had a town meeting, and they basically said, listen, are we going to do this or not? Because we can't be, you know, we can't have one village killing them and another one trying to preserve them. We have to all be in and be together or not. And they all unanimously agreed to stop, you know, hunting whale sharks and manta rays. And, you know, that was the dawn, really, of the beginning of all this, because it's one thing to, you know, let's say have laws in place, but it's another when people, you know, are in these very remote villages and they can get away with quite a bit when they all decide, okay, we're going to go ahead and take Sean's advice. So he's over there right now converting the boats into manta watching boats, and some of the nicer homes from the manta fishermen into bed and breakfasts, so people can, you know, stay with them. It's the jury's out to see if it's going to work, but that's what they're doing right now. And we've raised about $250,000 for seed financing to turn this village around. So, you know, you're seeing this very much at the very beginning stages. So, but, you know, that's always the case, you know, that these animals are always worth a lot more in the water than on the butcher's block.
Yeah.
You know, a manta ray, you know, from a fisherman's standpoint is worth about $500. But from a tourism standpoint, it can be worth to the whole community about $1 million. So, you know, if anybody, that's why they're very protective of the whale sharks down in Isla Mujeres in Mexico right now, that it's a big, huge industry, far more than shark fishing.
One of the most haunting images, I think, from the film comes fairly early on. It's in your conversations with Christopher Clark of Cornell at his lab. And he plays you the song of a bird, a male. Is it an o-o bird?
It is. It's a Hawaiian o-o.
O-o bird. And this bird is calling out to a mate, but there isn't one. He's the very last one on the planet.
This is a song recording of a male o-o singing on Kauai. These birds are made for life. So he would be singing a duet with his mate, where he sings and she sings back and forth. Here comes the male song. There's no response. Here's the male song again. That's the last male of a species singing for a female who will never come. He is totally alone. And now his voice is gone.
I promised we'd come back to hope, but it's difficult to feel hopeful at moments like that. You say in the film that there are a lot of ways to fix the problem, and in fact, you go through some of them. The question is, are we going to be able to do it fast enough? What do you think? How are you thinking about this right now?
Well, like I said, you know, that's a very early scene and a heart-wrenching scene in the film, you know, the O-O. And we bookend it, like I said earlier, of, you know, everything in the film is bookended with hope. Now, there's another bird with I want to say as beautiful as the song of an O-O, but it's the Florida grasshopper sparrow. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's down to about, you know, in just a few years, it went from 150 mating pairs to about 20 in this, you know, this region where you see most of them. And another friend of mine that I worked with at National Geographic, Joel Sartori, he's on a mission to try to photograph endangered species and every captured species on the planet.
Yeah.
And, you know, before he dies,
he's in the film, and he's great too. We should just
mention. He's a wonderful character, and I've known him for decades. But he's, you know, he says, like, you know, there's a term that the zoo, you know, zookeepers use, it's called phase out, when, you know, there's no longer support for an animal and, you know, they phase it out and it goes extinct, you know, without any fanfare at all. And he says, how are you going to ever save a little brown bird like the Florida grasshopper sparrow? But those pictures he took of the grasshopper sparrow made it on the way onto the cover of Audubon magazine. And that inspired Fish and Wildlife to put, you know, they were trying to save it with about 30,000 a year. And after they saw that picture and read the story, they invested, I think, like $1.2 million to try to turn things around for that bird. So images, you know, have a very, very strong role in turning our culture around. And that's what we, you know, we show in the film. I don't know if you want to get to it, but you know the big, the big operation that we did.
Oh yeah, you got to say something about this. The images that we see finally. I almost wanted to surprise people who see it, but for those who won't be able to, just say something about the projection of these images because it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, for about 4 years, and in fact, the film that we showed at Sundance, that we got into Sundance with, is a quite different film than the film that we have now. I've been trying for about 4 years to project endangered species on the Empire State Building.
Yeah.
And the reason that we were doing the Empire State Building is because about 80% of the greenhouse gases that are caused by cities are caused by commercial buildings like the Empire State Building. But Tony Malkin, the guy that owns the building, or is the CEO of the building that owns it, green that building, and he gets back $4.5 million a year from his electric bill because of the greening principles, and he's able to triple the rent in some cases because of it's more comfortable to work there. So there's a reason that we're using the Empire State Building as a projection surface, not just because it's the most iconic building in the world, but because of what they did. So it was August 1st, we did some of the biggest projections ever done. We had 20,000 lumen projectors out on a rooftop next to the Empire State Building. And we, for about 3 hours, we projected endangered species on that building. And I don't want to be too much of a spoiler alert, but I thought, okay, this is the way we can get the attention of the world. And, I've been trying since well into the last few years of the Bloomberg administration to do it, and I finally got it done, a couple weeks ago. We had almost 1 billion people see that event. It was, an extraordinary end to a long process to do this movie, but it was wonderful to get the world on the same page for a change.
Luis Sahoyos. We're showing his documentary Racing Extinction next Thursday evening, September 10th, at 7 p.m. at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Louis will join us for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Luis Sahoyos, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.